You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Good morning. I'm Cynthia Watson from the National War College, and I'd like to welcome you to this very timely discussion this morning of China, its role around the world, its role that domestic politics is playing, and its role around the world, and the way that the world is impacting on China and peaceful development. We're very privileged this morning to have my friend and colleague, Matt Furchin, from the Carnegie Center in Beijing and Tsinghua University. I really respect the fact that Matt's been doing a lot of work and substantive work, which is not what is happening in many ways in this town. There's a lot of blofiating, to make up a word, but Matt's doing substantive work on what role China has in engaging with Mr. Chavez Frias in Venezuela for at least as long as he is still in power, which could be a very short period of time. It doesn't appear to be very likely. But Matt's really delving into that key facet of China's interest in Venezuela, which is petroleum and the long-term relationship that that may engender. And I think he's come up with some very interesting findings that go beyond the first line of the newspaper to say, what does this tell us about China and what does this tell us about long-term involvement in other places? But you didn't come to hear from me, you came to hear from Matt. He's a scholar with a doctorate from Cornell University, a master's degree from the Seiss School across the street, and an undergraduate degree from the University of Puget Sound. Let me turn it over at this point to Matt. He's got about a half-hour presentation, and that should leave us plenty of time then for what I hope will be a number of really stimulating questions from all of you. Thank you, Matt.
Great. Thanks so much for that kind introduction, Cynthia. The title of my talk today, purposely kind of provocative, is China Too Liberal, China's Quixotic Search for Peaceful Development. This is an idea, the talk that I'm going to be giving, that I've had for a little over a year now. And so I'm really excited today to sort of experiment on you all with some of the ideas here. Some of what I'll be talking about, in particular what Cynthia was just mentioning in relation to China and Venezuela, will be somewhat familiar if you've read some of the things I've written recently. But much of what I'm saying here is going to be, I think, new and relatively broad in scope, but I'm also going to be looking at some specific issues. Just a few words by way of introduction, and then I'll get into the details. Again, the background and the sort of scope of my discussion today, and what I'm talking about is China Too Liberal and the sort of the concerns about the peaceful development policy are really related to my interest in political economy issues, and in particular China's engagement with resource-rich developing countries. My particular focus is on Latin America for the most part. But I think there's relevance for China's engagement with other similar resource-rich developing countries, particularly in Africa, but I think also in Southeast Asia, potentially the Middle East and Central Asia. So I'm really looking forward to hearing some of the feedback that you have on some of these basic ideas. The basic background question that I have, and the sort of problem that I'm trying to address, is why is it that the peaceful development policy that China has formulated does not really seem to be fully satisfying for China, for its developing country partners, or for the United States or other third-party observers? And I'll get into a little more about what I mean about that. And I think the answer, contrary to the conventional wisdom, is that in certain ways, both the peaceful development policy and China's foreign policy practice is actually too liberal. And I'll explain again what I mean by that in more detail. So what I'm going to be doing for the presentation now is, first of all, discussing what I mean by this conventional wisdom that somehow China is deeply realist and always thinking in terms of long-term strategy. I'm then going to explain what I mean by how the peaceful development policy itself is liberal and how some of the practices of Chinese foreign policy in the developing world are also driven by what I would call sort of liberal institutions. Then I'm going to present a critique of those, why these China being too liberal in terms of this policy is a concern both for some of China's developing country partners as well as for China and the United States. And finally, I'll talk about a few policy implications. Okay, so I think it is safe to say that the conventional wisdom about China is that China is fundamentally, to the core, culturally, historically, a realist country. Henry Kissinger has noted in his book on China that the Chinese are shrewd practitioners of realpolitik, and he would be the one to have the say on what realpolitik is. Ian Johnston, a political science professor at Harvard University, has written about the historical roots of what he calls China's realist strategic culture, arguing that going back hundreds, if not thousands of years, that China's approach to managing its relations with other countries is basically based on a version of realpolitik. Finally, more contemporary analyses of Chinese foreign policy, including a recent article in Foreign Affairs, argue that China, especially younger generation of Chinese international relations experts, are prone to believe that an offensive realist view of the world is relatively is the best way to view international relations. So that's a kind of scholarly and or sort of pundit-driven view of how China is realist. There are other sort of indications that would lend itself to the idea that China is somehow realist, including recent behavior. So there's this deep-seated sense of anxiety in China about U.S. policy of containment, about the so-called pivot, concerns that are basically based on a sort of zero-sum world in which the United States is trying to keep down China's rise. There is this sense, especially since the financial crisis, of a kind of newfound confidence and or aggression on the side of the Chinese, and this is in particular in seen in the East and South China Seas. And then there's a sort of baseline emphasis that China continues to have on sovereignty. Now, academics concerned about the sort of what is or what isn't realism could sort of pick holes in what the definition is. But I think it's safe to say that there's this general sense out there that China's somehow fundamentally realist. And then finally, in a more sort of economic realm or political economy realm, I think that the conventional wisdom is more or less that China is the modern day embodiment of something called state capitalism. Sometimes this gets referred to as the China model, but it basically means that China is using a kind of mercantilist, statist approach to economics, and that is not only important domestically, but also in terms of China's engagement with the world. So all of these add up as sort of historical, cultural view of the world and practice of foreign policy, recent behavior, both in terms of strategic, maybe military practice, as well as in terms of political economy. This, however, stands in very stark contrast to China's official foreign policy, which is embodied in the idea of peaceful development. So I think it was November of 2011 in which China came out with the document which embodies this idea of what peaceful development is. This was a long time in the works, and before this, it kind of replaced the idea of China's peaceful rise, which was seen as maybe too confrontational. So peaceful development is the policy. Not only is it in this peaceful development article or paper, but also if you were to look at China's white papers, official policy papers on Africa and on Latin America, you will see much of the same language reflected in those. The language that you see in all of these, I would argue, is deeply liberal, and liberal with not a sort of DC liberal tax and spend sort of thing, but the classic liberal idea. And some of the key concepts around this that you see consistently in China's diplomacy and again in these documents include the idea of win-win, mutually beneficial, complementary relations. So the idea is that China's engagement with the world is good not only for China, but also for its partners, and again, with specific reference to developing countries, and especially resource-rich developing countries. Tied to this is the idea of South-South relations being extremely important, and the idea that China, again, by doing well for itself, is also doing well for its trade and investment partners in the developing world. And the idea related to this is common development. And the implication here is that somehow China's engagement, especially with the developing world, is truly South-South, and it never... There's no real specific definition of what this exactly is, but it's implied that it's quite different from North-South. So China presents itself as a country that is that needs natural resources in particular. China is a resource-scarce developing country, and its natural partners, especially in the developing world, are resource-rich countries that will provide China with the inputs that it needs for its development. So everybody wins, no threat. And then the idea that follows from all of this, because China's engagement with the world, and especially with the developing world, is win-win and mutually beneficial and complementary, that the outcomes will therefore be harmonious. We know this is Hu Jintao's term, and we'll see if that changes. But another term that I think will continue to be in place is stable. You know, you could maybe put healthy in there. So the idea is that this complementarity, this win-win scenario, leads to harmonious, stable, and I think you can put in parentheses, political outcomes. So it's not just economic, but it's political outcomes. And underlying this, at the end of the day, is peace. All of this complementarity equals harmony and peace. I would be interested to hear thoughts on sort of what this, you know, what the background, why this document, why this policy is as it is. Let me give a few thoughts as to why I think... it is why China presents itself in this way. One of them is that it appeals to already standing global liberal norms for China to talk about win-win in this way. It fits with already standing ideas of global free trade, free flow of trade and investment, and that such an interdependence underpins global peace and stability, both economically and politically. I think it's also meant to sort of preempt concerns about China's rise. So if you have peaceful development with all of these components, then there's no real need for concern from the U.S., the West, or any of China's partners because it's complementary and peaceful and harmonious. I think there is also a part of that could be strategic, that China is appealing to what it sees in the world and sort of needs to appeal to assuage those who may be concerned about China's role in the world. But I think there's more to it than that. I think there is also a very deeply felt sense that China is a developing country, that China is part of the South. And this is a question of China's own identity and solidarity with developing countries. So when China says these things about being a South-South partner and providing common development, I think there's actually some real belief behind it. And I'm happy to talk about some instances of interactions that I've had where that really becomes clear to me. And finally, I think that China, through this language expressed through the Peaceful Development and other sort of white papers, is trying to follow up on this idea that China is and always has been a moral rather than a hegemonic power in the world, and that China is at heart a peaceful country, and that its interaction, its rise, its development will naturally lead to peaceful and harmonious outcomes. Okay, so what's the problem with this? I think there are two separate components to the problem with this sort of liberal view as expressed in peaceful development policies. One of them is really a sort of bilateral problem in terms of China's relations with some of its resource-rich developing partners. And this basically rests on the idea that China's happiness with complementarity and win-win scenarios is more than some of its developing country partners. They're less happy with the complementarity. They don't necessarily say, no, this isn't complementary, or you know, no one's pointing a gun to anyone's head and asking for or demanding resources. These are deals. China needs iron ore. It needs copper. It needs energy resources. And there are resource-rich countries around the world which are happy to provide those. Prices have been high for the last decade or so. So there's a general sense that the complementarity idea is more or less generally in the ballpark, but there has been, and I think there is increasing dissatisfaction with a number of China's trade and investment partners in the developing world, and I will talk about a few examples of that. In sort of thinking about why this is a problem, I decided I was going to go back and read E.H. Carr's 20 Years Crisis, written in 1939 initially, and it's one of, if not the, sort of classic realist critique of utopian liberalism. Carr was criticizing 19th century ideas that sort of global interdependence, globalization, was naturally lending itself to peaceful outcomes. The idea that the world was increasingly globally interdependent in the late 19th century and before World War I, people had sort of decided and argued that there could not be, that war was not possible, that sort of negative outcomes was not possible. It's amazing the amount, I think, of congruity when I read Carr's critique of the language that was used both in late 19th century and then in between the World War I and World War II. Much of the language that he's critiquing you can find in the Peaceful Development and other white paper documents. And Carr's critique is fairly extensive, but his point is that in these complementary relations, in the idea that liberal ideas that go back to Adam Smith, that if I do well by myself and you do well by yourself, the outcome is happiness for everyone. He says that's never really been the case. When times are good, that's a more likely scenario, or people are more likely to sort of buy that. And the more powerful like that story, better than the less powerful. I think this makes a lot of sense in thinking about sort of why China's happy with this and some of its developing country partners are less happy with it. Carr went on to have a much more extensive critique about this and a sort of realist response to this. I'm not really going to go into that. But I think he really hits on, I think it's a useful comparison to think about his critique of this and just basically saying that usually this sort of language, liberal language, is often the language of those in a sort of dominant position or who are doing better maybe in the relationship than others. Great Britain has used this language historically, and the United States, of course. In terms of specific examples of countries that have sort of expressed an unease with the language of complementarity, I think the best example is actually Brazil. So when President Dilma Rousseff came to office in early 2011, one of her first pronouncements about China-Brazil relations was that they must move from this language of complementarity and South-South to beyond complementarity. So to me, that is one of the clearest expressions of a sort of unease that a fellow member of BRICS has with the complementarity as good enough sort of approach. In Brazil, you see a great deal of concern about rising dependency, so that exports of raw materials are an increasingly large part of Brazil's export basket and to one country, so China. So sort of moving away from a more diverse economic base to one that is increasingly reliant on the exports of just a few primary goods. There are domestic political battles that maybe sort of play this up in Brazil beyond what it is, but this is certainly a concern. I think we see this idea that maybe dependency on primary resource exports to China and or sort of concern about China's investment in especially in natural resources, but also China's competitiveness in terms of exports to these countries in return for raw material imports. You see this, I think, also expressed in the case of Burma. I think you see it elsewhere in the southern cone of Latin America. I think Zambia at one point was an interesting case of this, also concern about sort of copper dependency. Again, you know, you have a presidential candidate that plays this up and then sort of changes in attitude a little bit later on. But certainly this idea of dependency is out there. And Australia, not a developing country, but certainly a country that has very similar concerns about this sort of dependency. So yeah, it's complementary, but it's creating a great deal of unease, and everyone's wondering, well, what happens when the price of iron ore, copper, and other commodities drop? And that's already happened in the last year in a couple of cases, especially iron ore. The other element of sort of China being too liberal, which is sort of separate from the language that I've been talking about of complementarity and such, really goes back to domestic Chinese politics and domestic Chinese governance, and in particular governance of state-owned enterprises and their behavior in China's going-out policy. Sort of how Chinese state-owned enterprises, which are not the only, but often some of the key organizations entrusted with China's efforts to go out and get access to raw materials, energy, agriculture, and minerals. And I think an interesting comparison here is that for quite some time, the United States was concerned about the behavior of multinational companies and the sort of foreign policy challenges or headaches that that multinational companies engaging around the world have created. You get books in the 1970s talking about the end of sovereignty, the idea that you get these really powerful multinational corporations that are somehow acting in a way that is drawing the United States and other Western countries into sorts of engagement around the world that create foreign policy headaches in which the government then has to go in and clean up. China has its own version of this, and I think it's not yet fully appreciated. And China's version of this is slightly different. United States and other European multinationals were, by and large, private. In China, they're state-owned. This gets very tricky. Now, does that mean that they're acting sort of at the behest or because of clear central government directives in China? Are they acting... are they profit-seeking? There are obviously debates about this. They're somewhere in between. They're a little bit of both. But one thing is sure, and that is that some of China's state-owned banks and some of China's state-owned enterprises are out there engaging in the world, accessing raw materials, and drawing China into what I think are maybe unnecessary risks. I think some of the clearest examples of this are in China's engagement with energy-rich countries, especially oil-rich countries, Iran, Sudan, even potentially Libya, Burma. And then most recently in the subject of some of my more recent research is Venezuela. And I think what we see is some of China's banks and state-owned enterprises are acting in a way in which they sort of nationalize or corporatize risk. So they go engage with the Venezuelan president and oil company, supposedly to access oil for China's domestic market. And as I've argued elsewhere, a lot of that is being resold. So there is a bit of a disconnect then. We have some of these state-owned enterprises, banks, out there acting in a way that is not necessarily in the long-term strategic interest of China. And why is this liberal? Well, I think it's a sort of outgrowth of China's state capitalism, but these companies are sort of acting in this middle ground. Yes, they're supported by the government. They represent China in a way, and yet they are also acting on their own corporate interest and seeking profit. And I think this is leading China into certain difficulties. Again, the scope of this is interesting. Where is this a problem and where is it not necessarily, I think, is very interesting. What's the role of domestic governance? So if Venezuela managed its own oil company and market better, this may not be such a problem. So I think these are interesting questions to try to tease out, and maybe we can talk a little bit about. Okay, let me conclude with some ideas about policy implications. The first of them, I think, is simply a recognition that China is acting or has these very sort of liberal ideas deeply embedded in its core foreign policy and especially in its relations with the developing world. And I think it's also important that some of China's developing country partners, as well as the United States and other third parties, have a sense of this idea that China is actively trying to show the world that it is really sort of fitting in with a lot of these liberal norms, but that there are real complications to this. And I, on the one hand, I would like to say that I think it's a naive assumption on China's side that these sort of complementary South-South mutually beneficial relations will equal harmony and peace. I think it's a very complicated mix, like I was expressing before, of reasons why it is that this sort of gets embodied in the official foreign policy. But to the extent that it's actually believed by Chinese officials, companies, whatever, and or the trade partners, that we just trade, you have what we need, everybody's happy, I think this sets expectations at a level that are very unrealistic. And so I think there needs to be some engagement, some discussion about sort of how to potentially have more realistic expectations. I think the United States has clearly been down this road before in terms of both presenting a liberal rhetoric about how it sees the world and how it sees itself acting, and maybe a disconnect with actual action or how others perceive it. So the United States has some experience with this. And in particular, the United States also has experience with sort of governance of multinational corporations. I think China needs to do a better job of thinking about how to govern the behavior of its state-owned enterprises abroad. You know, one solution to this is to privatize state-owned enterprise. I don't see that necessarily happening. I'm not sure it's necessarily the way to go. But if you're going to have state-owned enterprises, and if they're going to be out there in the world acting in the name of China, I think there needs to be a fundamental reconsideration on the China's leadership's part about how to govern these entities and not get into unnecessary situations like I see happening in particular in Venezuela, but as a number of Chinese and other analysts have seen in the case of Iran or Sudan. Another possible area of discussion about sort of experience, I think, is what really are the foundations of economic and political stability. So China confronted with a crisis in Venezuela, what do you do? Or in Burma? What are your thoughts? What are the principles upon which China should act in thinking about how to create a more institutionally stable environment in these countries in which it has a major impact? And hopefully, I think there's room for dialogue with the United States and others on this about sort of what these institutions might be. Finally, China finds itself at an extremely interesting stage, which I think the United States was at maybe around the time of just after World War II. China is now a global actor, but it understands relatively little about many of the regions with which it's interacting. At Tsinghua University, where I'm a professor in the International Relations Department, I'm the only faculty member who works on China's relations with any region outside of basically China and the U.S. and China Europe. China needs to have knowledge about how other parts of the world work. The United States really got going with its area studies programs, funded by the government, funded by private citizens, after World War II, when it realized, oh, we're a global power. We're going to have to deal with the world, and we better understand it, or else we're going to have problems. Now, the United States has some, I think, of the best institutions for creating this knowledge. Whether or not that translates into good policy all the time is another question. But I think there's clear complementarity here, where the United States and China can cooperate on sort of how do you understand other parts of the world and seek to create a more stable and harmonious environment. So thank you for your time and look forward to the discussion.
I'd like to say thanks, Matt. I thought that was terrific. I think it really does raise some very different questions than have been raised so far about China's involvement. It doesn't go to the sense of panic that many people see in that involvement, but you're really asking us to think in a truly analytical way about some of the things and hopefully get the Chinese to think about those things. I think the other point that I would raise is I have no idea where everyone in this room is from, but some of the other actors also need to ask the same questions that you're asking that China ask. So I think that this really opens some interesting ideas for us to think about as China does increasingly engage around the world. If you have a question, please stand and identify yourself, and we'll open up. We've got about 40 minutes or about 50 minutes for questions. Sir, at the back. Could you wait for the mic, please?
David Chang, I'm with the Department of State. I'm very interested in your presentation, and I thought that maybe some of the disconnect of China and the rest of the world has a sort of cultural background. If you look at the United States and its multinationals, when it's invested overseas, there is not only the economic aspect, but also there's a connection with the cultural, you know, through Hollywood, through movies and all that. I think the Chinese connection is very limited. It's mostly looking at Latin America, where I lived for about 10 years, is mostly through food, you know, the restaurants. In fact, until fairly recently, the concept of Chinese that the Latin Americans had was a bunch of people in pigtails and, you know, bound feet. So there hasn't been that cultural connection in any way except through the restaurants. And if there is more of a cultural connection, perhaps there's a better understanding. Well, I'd like to hear your views on that. Thanks.
Yeah, I think this is a primary concern of Chinese diplomacy. Certainly this idea of soft power, which I would say borders on an obsession among my colleagues and everyone that I talk to in China. So there's a real concern about this, and also in terms of public diplomacy. What should China be doing differently to sort of have a more well-rounded impact and also a sort of leave a positive impression? The problem, especially in Latin America, but I think also elsewhere, is that this is a relatively new relationship still. I mean, a decade ago, it really is when the boom in trade relations took off, and it's far away. So how do you sort of attempt to overcome this on the part of sort of Chinese diplomacy is not going to be easy. But at the very least, I think, again, going back to the question of governance of state-owned enterprises, you can sort of do better. And I think China's recognize this, slowly starting to recognize that corporate social responsibility kinds of practices on the part of companies is big. The other side of this, though, and it's much bigger in Africa than in Latin America, is the non-state investment. You have lots and lots of private Chinese citizens going abroad, and how do you control that, I think, is a very interesting question. In contrast to this, though, I think in places like Southeast Asia, where you have a much larger overseas Chinese community, I actually think China has more to work with in terms of sort of cultural capital there, but I think it needs to be more flexible. You have these overseas Chinese communities, and so I was in Southeast Asia over the Chinese New Year holiday, and they're having a big celebration, but it's unlike you would have in Beijing, and it's not orchestrated by Beijing. I think that's a good thing, but I also think that from a point of view of sort of China's public diplomacy and such, it's a bit of discomfort there. There's a desire to control what the impression of China is. So there, I think, are different things that China can do, but certainly it's something that is on the minds of people thinking about how to improve China's soft power, cultural capital, and influence around the world.
Michael.
Thanks very much. Mike Fonte. I work as the Washington liaison for the Democratic Progressive Party of Taiwan. I wonder if one couldn't take a very different cut on all this and ask whether Marxist ideology isn't the fundamental underlying principle. I mean, it seems to me one could make the case that that's the way the Chinese leadership thinks. Now, how they implement it at home or abroad is a different question, but, you know, building a world in which a non-exploitative system, economic system, et cetera. I mean, it seems to me there's it's not liberal, it's really Marxist, and we, I think, in this country tend to think, oh, that's no longer viable anywhere. But I just wonder what your thoughts would be on that.
Oh, that's great. The funny thing is I'm about to go back to Beijing on Monday, and I teach international political economy, and I've got to teach this class on what the difference between liberalism and Marxism is. It's a fine line in a lot of ways. The sort of basic idea that the sort of material base is really what impacts the political outcomes, that's deeply ingrained. What's ironic and interesting about it in the case of China is I think it fits. It meshes really easily with that sort of Marxist background. But instead of it being exploitative, it's good for everybody. It jumps out at you when you read the peaceful development document or these other white papers that I mentioned. The positive spin put on this, and if we were to go back not so long ago, imagine what the negative spin on that would have been. So I think you're right, and it gets sort of tricky. I think the baseline idea that material reality sets the basis for those political outcomes is absolutely the case. It's just you spin it a little bit, you turn it a little bit, and it goes from exploitative to everybody's happy and peaceful outcomes.
Let me ask you a question, Matt, that's more of a policy question. You've talked about this in relatively positive terms, and you've talked about a lack of
understanding on Beijing's part of these regions that they are engaging with, and that certainly in my own research is what I found. My question would be back to your point about the SOEs, and I would say policy in general, wagging the dog. What are they thinking in Beijing? What kinds of discussions are you hearing about places where things do go awry? I think Venezuela is a clear example of a place where we do not know what's going to happen, but it's only one. Things have already gone south in many ways in Africa. We don't have to wait and see. Copper prices did drop after 2008. How is Beijing reacting to that? But more importantly, how are they trying to systematically, if at all, think about those kinds of questions?
Well, I guess my first answer is there's a huge range of ideas. People disagree on a lot of these things. So a lot of it comes back to sort of domestic regulation of certain markets. Let's say it's the energy market within China. Some people are quite critical of the idea that China's own domestic energy markets are ill-regulated, and therefore this is having a negative impact. It creates too much demand. And others say, no, that's not really the problem. What we really need to focus on is sort of ramping up China's naval power in order to secure, you know, the waterways and such. So there are active debates about a number of these things. And then what you also have, though, so when I was mentioning beyond complementarity, I did a quick Google search for this last night, and it reminded me there was actually a conference funded by a Chinese government trade bureau called Beyond Complementarity, in which they invited a bunch of senior Brazilian officials to come and talk about this. And there's a big China-Latin America trade conference every fall. And the last year, the idea was, let's talk about how we can sort of move beyond this basic resources for manufacturers trade relationship. So, and that's probably strategic in part. So, you know, we hear what you're saying. And Wen Jiabao's trip to South America last summer, he also sort of echoed this concern. We hear what you're saying. Then the question is, what do you do? Because really this comes down to comparative advantage. China's, I think, fully believes, we're good at this, we need this, you have it. So you may talk about it, but what are you going to do? I don't think there's a strategy yet, but what you see is some, first of all, you see debates, and the second of all, you see some action to respond, even if it's just rhetorically at this point, and saying, we hear you, let's try to think of some solutions.
My name is Enrique Ortiz. I work mainly in Peru, Brazil, Bolivia, and Ecuador. I work for the Blue Moon Fund. Part of our work is to support civil society to monitor environmental impacts of major infrastructure projects in the region. And it is a surprise to me to see how Chinese investments go through deals in those countries that easy, or not easy, but I would say in a kind of hidden way and very effectively, as opposed to, say, U.S. investments. It's a mystery because, you know, there is a lot of monitoring of everything happening mainly from the U.S., but suddenly there are major deals happening between China and these countries. Been trying to explain why is that, and I guess part of what you say makes a lot of sense, but I think there are other factors. For example, that there is a tradition of anti-imperialistic behavior, particularly in Bolivia, somewhat in Peru and Ecuador, against other superpowers that include Brazil itself. So there are a number of deals lately of Chinese, the Chinese government with Peru and Bolivia, which in some ways are counteracting or are, I guess, buffering the higher or the bigger impact that Brazil is having in the region. I would like to hear your thoughts about that.
Well, I think you're exactly right that China has a very different approach to some of this, and there's a receptivity, especially among some of the ALBA countries, to Chinese investment. And I think what this sort of highlights also is that a lot of what I'm talking about in terms of what Chinese state-owned enterprises do on the ground in any part of the world, or sort of what the receptivity is going to be to China, really has a lot to do with local political and economic institutions. I think it's always been that way. So in some places that's healthier, and in some places it's less healthy. I think there's certainly a tendency on the Chinese side to like to deal with with the highest level of leadership who control things. And so if the president says yes, it's a go, then yes, it's a go. The problem is once you're in with that person, especially in the case of Chavez, and something happens or the rest of the institutional structure becomes dysfunctional, then you have a big problem. So I think on the question of whether or not these deals are opaque or more transparent, whether they're healthy or not, so much of that just rests on the approach of the host countries still. I think Chinese firms and the embassies are going to adapt to the environment that they face. I think a very interesting experiment is underway, and I think Venezuela is at the heart of it. I think we'll see if China sort of sees that the experience that it's having in Venezuela is really not what it would like to see in the future in Venezuela and elsewhere, and if it therefore starts to sort of try to, you know, whether it's individual companies or the government in general, try to change the pattern of engagement. And what's interesting is you have Colombia right next door. You have the kind of the anti-Venezuela, in a way, right next door in terms of these institutional structures and attitude towards things. Rule of law, you got to come in and go through a formal bidding process, and you can't just talk to the president and get something through. All these things are, you know, the opposite of what you have in Venezuela. And it will be interesting to see if there, as a result of the Venezuela experience, is a sort of change to sort of feel more comfortable with a Colombia type situation. But then, as you mentioned, you also have leaders in Bolivia or Ecuador who are, for a range of reasons, still happy to be engaging with China. So I think we have a really interesting point of the sort of the nature of engagement that we're going to see with China and Latin America.
Hi, I'm Kome Isozaki, a visiting fellow at CSIS. I have a question about understanding of China and the regions each other. You mentioned that there is a lack of understanding from China's side to the regions they are investing.
Sure.
I wonder if there is any effort by the regions to understand China, such as establishing China studies or programs or sending students to China, and how does that match with the effort of China to understand the regions?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think we see efforts on both sides. It's increasing, but it's very new. So we see a major research center in Mexico, which is kind of ironic because the China-Mexico relationship is maybe the most dysfunctional of all of China's relations with Latin American countries, especially major countries. Brazil is increasing the number of think tanks and research centers, and you see a push throughout the region. I know in Costa Rica, which has, you know, a new diplomatic agreement and foreign and free trade agreement, their efforts to increase the capacity of, you know, local knowledge about China. I actually have no idea about this in Africa. Interestingly, in Burma, friends who work there, I've been shocked by the sort of lack of knowledge, sort of on both sides. But I almost see that the possibility there of more interest, like if you were going to create an institution to sort of teach about China, I'm not sure who would go. I think people would prefer to go and learn about the United States or Western Europe or something. So part of it is going to be a question of demand. But I see this on the Chinese side as well. There's an increasing sense, especially with Latin America. It was ignored years ago when I told people I was interested in this. They said, why would you do that? It's all about the U.S. That's changing quickly. And especially with, you know, China's engagement in the region. So you see this, but it's still deeply limited. And especially at the university level in China, very, very, very little. But even my department just this year is starting a new PhD program in developing country studies. And so Tsinghua, my guess, is the first university to have this. So it's relatively limited at this point, but I think it's going to grow pretty quickly.
I would just add that 10 years ago, I made a research trip on this topic to Brazil and Chile. And there, I could count on one hand how many people looked at China in those two countries. And it has, I would say it's actually exploded.
Yeah.
And I think that the other part of this that Matt hasn't addressed, and there's no reason you would have, but from the Latin American side, I think it's also a view that the U.S. focus is no longer on this region, and therefore China is a likely partner. And I think that that's part of the dynamic that the Chinese are able to play upon.
Yeah. Matt, Yukon Huang at Carnegie here. I wonder if you could elaborate on two particular points. If a excessively liberal strategy has its negative drawbacks, could you sketch out a little bit more about what you think would be a better policy, what how it would show up, or what aspects would be what you think a more effective approach? And the second point I'd like you to comment on is a little bit like, is this actually a China issue at all? What exactly is different between the relationship between China and these resource-rich countries in Latin America and, let's say, the major powers 3 or 4 decades ago, when you had the same concerns about the exploitative relationships between the West and these resource countries? And a related question here is, in terms of the economic literature, there's two points which basically come out. One is that more and more the sense that the resource curse is really a resource curse. Practically all countries with extensive resources have bad governance structures. So whoever they interact with, whether it be a China, United States, France, or whatever, or Japan, in the sense that if you have a lot of resources, it's extraordinarily hard to evolve a governance structure which effectively deals with the others. So whoever you deal with, you end up with a negative relationship. Now, the only countries in which it doesn't turn out to be the case are resource-rich countries with some sense of good governance structure, but very few people. Because if you have a lot of people, along with resources, who are relatively poor, then fundamentally the relationship between exporting minerals to a country who wants them, who are industrializing, means that they have a lot of people that need to be employed, and that's why they buy your resources. But you sell a lot of resources, and inevitably what it means is you don't actually generate labor-generating jobs for your poor people. So the relationship is fundamentally incompatible in the long-term sense of the frictions it's created. So it's a little bit more like, is there in fact an economic relationship between these two resource-exporting and importing country, which is industrializing, which is fundamentally leads to conflict? And then now my question is, how do you deal with this issue?
So I'm going to start with your second question because I think that will help me answer your first. I think the answer in part is, at least especially in terms of the basic material relationship, this isn't a China issue. It's just China's the latest country that is going through this stage of development, and you know, at a certain scale, it has created a natural resource boom. And it's the along with India and others, but it's at the heart of you know, it's driving demand for a lot of these products. And in a way that other countries that went through rapid industrialization in the North did before. So in one of my classes, I often show this basic, just a chart with China, China's exports of manufacturers and Latin American exports of raw materials. And what you see is this huge, you know, you call it complementarity. And I look at that and I ask my students, is that South-South? That structural relationship is the same as we have seen in the past. So I think, however, there are two differences, and they're sort of political or maybe institutional differences. One of them is the idea that China adamantly says, no, we're South. So when you look at that, that chart and that idea of complementary, and China says it's complementary, and Latin America or others say, no, that's dependency. So there is an idea, and China's trying to sell itself as this country that's saying, well, this is just good for everyone. And by the way, we're a developing country. We get what it means to be a developing country. But if structurally they look like the North, then there's a disconnect there, I think, part of what I was trying to get at, of like kind of the discomfort on the trade and investment partner side, and maybe what, you know, when China hears criticism about this, it's deeply discomforting. I see this very frequently. People don't want to be criticized. Like, no, we are the South. And then the other side of it is the sort of structure of state-owned enterprises. In this recent article that I wrote on China and Venezuela, I make a clear point that if it were private Chinese oil companies going to Venezuela, you would have a different situation than you have right now. You know, oil companies and the banks. If you had private banks and private oil companies, it would not be China engaging in state-to-state deals with Venezuela. Now, you may have some of the same problems, and clearly the United States had to deal with the impact of its multinationals and the people there, and if they were nationalized and all of this, there are implications. But I think there is a difference for China, especially diplomatically, in dealing with this. When you have, how do you govern these institutions? So I think there's something about the particulars of China having this sort of state capitalist structure that does make a difference. Now, what do you do about that? Well, I think you can try to, first of all, engage differently. I think you have to set expectations differently. The outcomes aren't going to just be happy for everyone. And I think this is what China's already starting to do. I was mentioning that you have a conference on beyond complementarity. Okay. Then let's think about this. If we're concerned about you becoming dependent or whatever, the other side, though, in terms of governance of you know the resource curse, I think, did the United States ever come up with an answer to this? I don't think so. In terms of engaging with difficult partners who are going to create problems down the road. You may cooperate for a while over resources, but when you have, say, in Egypt, a revolution based on a sort of dysfunctional government, then, you know, what's the position that you're going to have? So,
can I press you a little bit about the state enterprises?
Yep.
If you're not familiar with the Venezuelan piece, clarify a little bit more the difference between if it were a private company as opposed to a state company in terms of its interaction and the outcome.
I think it's political. I think that the outcome itself is political, and the expectations that the world has about what these companies are. They're state-owned enterprises, therefore they sort of represent the Chinese government, and I think they are seen, in the case of Venezuela in particular, but I think you can also look at this in Sudan and Iran, that these companies are then seen, and they bring China diplomatically into a situation through state-to-state deals in which they are seen as supporting Chavez, or seen as supporting a government in Iran or Sudan that is a kind of pariah. And if it were a private company, the government wouldn't have to sort of deal with that.
But that same perception of, for example, major U.S. oil companies in the Middle East, you think it's different? They were private, but they weren't seen as aspects of the U.S. government?
It's a gray line. But yes, I think it's different. I absolutely think it's different. And I think that this has come out through discussions. I was struck by it too. In the case of Latin America, people were saying these are state to state deals. I'm like, well, yeah, but those state enterprises aren't really listening. So I'm not sure it's so accurate to think of them as the state, but that's the perception. No one's talking about Chevron as America in Venezuela right now, I don't think. You know, maybe that's naive. Maybe they're the same. But I do think there's a perception difference, and I think it matters politically. And people in China who are working on sort of energy security issues are also concerned about this. I've heard more and more people saying we need different, better governance of these institutions.
I would add that in the Venezuelan case, I think also Chavez Frias very much wants it to be seen that
Absolutely.
Way, which is part of it. That doesn't mean in the Middle East they don't seek to believe that there is that linkage between U.S. oil companies, but in the Venezuelan case, they definitely are trying to capitalize on that. And it's meant as a message, frankly, for the United States, among other things. Other questions? Ma'am.
Hi, my name is Sarah Salinas, and I'm from the Center for American Progress. My question is just on, you know, we're talking about the state-owned enterprises and sort of their issue with kind of seen as representing China when they go into these countries. But there's been recent discussion on kind of their responsibility to China and kind of giving some profits back to the country and kind of alleviating this issue of income inequality within China. So what should the administrative focus be on kind of helping the SOEs manage their responsibilities within China and externally? And do you think that that's a burden that is maybe making them sort of act ineffectively abroad? Do you think that that's an issue? And what should the administrative focus be in helping the SOEs go forward?
I think the answer to that may be the same for the regulation or the governance of state-owned enterprises within China as much as it is outside of China. And this is an active discussion that's happening right now. The 2030 report from the World Bank in partnership with the Chinese institution last year sort of pointed to this idea that state-owned enterprises need to be reformed, that the sort of profit sharing of state-owned enterprises needs to be transformed. In some cases, there may need to be sort of consolidation of certain state-owned enterprises. In other cases, you know, something akin to privatization. So this is an ongoing discussion there, and I don't really see it being all that much different in the international aspect of it, especially when it comes to things like, you know, profit sharing or whatever. But certainly, if I think about the case of Venezuela, and if we have the China Development Bank and the national oil companies there, and if, you know, where do their profits go from the resale of Venezuelan oil? Who knows? Now, if you were to argue, if those companies were to say they're going back into programs for domestic development that will be spread, used publicly, then I think that's a legitimate argument in a way. Maybe it is or maybe it isn't the most efficient way to run it. But if they're taking those profits for themselves in some sort of corporate sense, sort of privatizing them, and yet exposing the country to difficult political risk abroad, then that's an altogether different issue. I think, especially with the going out policy, the increasing amount of investment and support for that among state-owned enterprises, it's so new. It's as new as these relationships, you know, with Latin America and Africa. And if there are problems with governing state-owned enterprises domestically, problems with corruption, problems with inefficiency and such, they're compounded internationally. How do you go about monitoring what those companies are doing? It's a huge headache, but I think it's one that needs to start to be addressed.
Other questions? Well, if there aren't any other questions, I'd like to say, Matt, thank you very much for a stimulating conversation, and thank you all for attending today.
Thanks so much.